Today, a climber tells us about trying to summit Everest during one of the deadliest years on record, and a look at Helsinki's radical solution to homelessness. When you think of Mount Everest, you might picture determined and solitary climbers bracing themselves for the remote and wild 8,800-metre ascent to stand on top of the Earth.
I mean, the views never change. It's magnificent up there. I mean, you know, there's no higher point on the planet. So you're seeing, you know, some of the tallest mountains on Earth. It's like a forest of mountains beneath you. When the weather's clear, you can see for as far as the eye can see, and it's riveting.
So tell me about this most recent climb. When you set off, at what point did you start to get a sense that something about this climb was a bit different?
I would say it was on our way to Camp 4, and you know, there was probably a lineup of, you know, 40 to 70 people ahead of us. It was the first time that I saw with my own eyes, you know, a queue that long on Mount Everest.
This year's climbing season will be defined by one image, and it was taken by a Nepalese climber named Nirmal Pujra on the morning of 23 May, and it shocked a lot of people because it looked like the line outside of a concert or something.
This line of people stretches right into the distance, all of them balancing on a knife-edge ridge in the area known as the death zone, where there isn't enough oxygen to breathe and where most deaths occur. 11 people have died on the mountain already this year.
And obviously, you know, the loss of life, it's just so difficult. And, you know, you ask yourself the question, like, you know, was it worth it? Was it really worth it?
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, why are people dying trying to summit Everest? You have just come down from the summit of Everest.
That's correct, yeah. I summited on the 23rd of May, 2019. This is actually my 8th expedition, if you can believe it, to Everest. And very grateful to have stood on top of the world for the 3rd time this year.
Elias Sakali is a filmmaker and climber. He made his 8th trip up Everest this May. Take me to the summit. What is it like? What was it like the very first time you stood there?
It was absolutely exhilarating. I had actually turned back twice from the summit in 2007 and 2009 because of bad weather. So I was 500 feet from the top of the world both times, and the changing weather patterns forced us back. So that first time when I actually made it up there in 2010, it was an incredibly inspiring and meaningful moment.
And it must take a lot of training to just to have the level of fitness to get up there.
It does, yeah. I mean, you're talking about almost 9,000 meters above sea level, right? And, you know, there are moments where you're taking 4 or 5 breaths, you know, for every step that you make onwards and upwards. You know, the reason why it takes you 7 weeks to climb Everest is because you have to go through a series of acclimatization rotations. So, you know, obviously you cannot climb directly to the summit. You know, your body would never be able to handle it. So essentially what you do is you climb high and you sleep low.
Right, so you do a series of rotations, basically, where you gradually work your way up higher and higher to different camps, and then you come back down in between each time to rest, sort of slowly acclimatizing. And that includes Camp 3, which is near the area known as the death zone, where that photograph was taken, and where your body really struggles. The oxygen is so low there. So after that, you come back down and rest. But then what happens?
Then you're waiting for that weather window. So, you know, for 5 to 12 days per year, there's a window where the jet stream actually is, you know, sort of pushed off, you know, because of the storms of the Bay of Bengal. And it opens up this weather window where everybody has an opportunity to actually stand on top of the world.
How did you feel seeing that queue?
It was alarming. You know, the very first thing that I thought is, you know, what is going to happen up there? You know, how are we going to deal with this? And, you know, while I 100% trusted the leadership of our team and tried not to worry, you know, there was that, you know, sort of inner voice that was just sort of screaming and saying, okay, like, are we going to make the summit? And I think more importantly than that, you know, what's going to happen, and hopefully there isn't going to be a disaster up there.
And from then on, you described the scene, the rest of your ascent up the mountain, as death, carnage, chaos, lineups. What happened? What did you see to make you write this?
Within 20 minutes of departing Camp 4, there was a climber that was being brought down by two Sherpas, and that person was lifeless. You know, that's completely alarming, right? And you just think, oh God, you know, like, you know, what else is coming? And, you know, within 45 minutes of that moment, there was another climber that was being brought down. And again, it's very confusing, right? Because you're having a hard enough time dealing with the lack of oxygen, your brain's not working properly. And this climber was delirious. You know, this climber was, you know, singing and screaming, and you know, the queue's pushing you up the line, you have to keep moving. And so this was, you know, the beginning of our summit climb. The next moment that was, you know, very disturbing was when we came across the first deceased climber, you know, a human being that had lost their life. And that person's body was fixed to an anchor point between two safety lines. And every single person that, you know, was climbing up towards the summit had to step over that human being.
Oh my God.
It was devastating. Yeah, it was very difficult.
Do many people move on from ill people, dead people on the ground?
You know, it's difficult for people at sea level who are not mountaineers, who have never been above 8,000 meters, to understand that particular scenario. Because if we were at sea level, for example, and we were to see a friend, a loved one, you know, passed out on the ground, you know, something going wrong, you would immediately respond. You would have the strength and the oxygen and the atmosphere to easily, you know, work as a group to, you know, pick that person up and, you know, bring that person to the hospital. You know, when you're on Everest and you're in the death zone and you can barely think and your brain is starved of oxygen and your extremities are numb, and you're just trying to stay alive and survive because your body cannot live above 8,000 meters, it becomes a very complicated situation. And, you know, you realize in your mind that, you know, your fate could be the same, right? And with a lineup pushing you up the mountain, there's nothing you can do. And so you really have no choice but to carry on. I think it's a very, very different situation if a person is suffering or if a person has a problem. You know, to walk past that individual would be a crime, in my opinion.
What is the problem with so many people on the mountain?
What's really alarming to me is the potential of something far greater to go wrong. Even just the climb from, you know, Camp 3 to Camp 4, when you see, you know, 40 or so people on a single safety line, if that safety line were to snap, for example, you know, there's the potential of dozens of people plummeting off the side of Mount Everest.
So, Michael, let's go like right back to the beginning with Everest. How did it attain its symbolic status? Obviously, it's huge. It's the tallest in the world. But how did it become so symbolic?
The Tibetans who lived to the north of the mountain called it, and I'm sure I'll butcher this, but it's Jomo Lungma, which translates to a goddess, mother of the world. Now, for the Nepalis, they called the peak Sagarmatha, which means goddess of the sky. So to both of those cultures, this was something that was seen as very special.
Michael Safi is the Guardian's South Asia correspondent.
For the West, for the British in particular, it took on very quickly this mythical status. The early 20th century, this was an age of adventurers. It was seen as this incredible challenge that anyone with an adventurous spirit would want to conquer.
Right, so then it was first conquered by Edmund Hillary and the Nepalese Sherpa mountaineer Tenzing Norgay.
I think my first reaction was definitely one of relief. A relief that we'd found the summit, for one thing.
Yes.
And relief that we were there.
That was in 1953. And did they report how difficult it was, the challenges that they had up there?
They did write about how difficult it was. I mean, for one thing, they were absolutely exhausted. I mean, the air is so thin up at that height. I mean, if you don't have supplementary oxygen, you're essentially suffocating slowly. On top of that, they didn't have someone going ahead of them with a rope who was carving out the path and helping them kind of hook a line to it. They were actually carving this path themselves. And there's a famous section that's notoriously difficult and required them to sort of shimmy between two ridges in order to get up there. And that's now known as the Hillary Step after Edmund Hillary.
So after Hillary and Norgay's successful summit, the possibility of scaling the mountain slowly started to open up to more people. But there was a turning point in the 80s. Why was that?
This is usually attributed to the successful climb of a 55-year-old Texan businessman whose name was Dick Bass.
I never planned really to climb anything except out of bed every morning, and that was tough enough, believe me.
He was essentially helped to the top by a climber called David Breeshears, and this received a huge amount of attention, that suddenly this mountain was something that the average person, or perhaps the above average person, could aspire to climb if they only had enough money to do so. And it helped to change the idea of Everest in people's consciousness. And then over the course of the next 15 years, the Nepali government in particular recognized that there was a huge amount of money to be made in this.
So how big then is the business of Everest?
Well, it's very big business. The Ministry of Tourism in Nepal reported last year that they collected $5.2 million in permit fees, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but Nepal, we have to remember, is a very poor country. It's a country that's struggling to rebuild after its 2015 earthquake. And so the prospect of drawing in $5.2 million in permit fees alone, not counting what people might pay for hotels, what people might pay to their adventure companies, money given to Sherpas. This is a big industry.
What has that meant for the mountain and for the community around it?
Well, the main consequence is that the number of people who climb Everest each year is growing. And that's partly because of demand, but also because the Nepalese government in particular continues to give out record numbers of permits. So this year it gave out 381 climbing permits to foreigners. It's often described as a bit of a free-for-all. There's been this huge springing up of budget expedition companies. One of the complaints of more experienced climbers is that some of these budget companies that have sprung up in the last 10 years have much lower fitness requirements, much lower experience requirements. You know, famously, a couple of years ago, an experienced climber said that he walked past a group of people who had their crampons attached the wrong way, and he was stunned. For him, this was like a symbol of the fact that the mountain that was once restricted to the elite had become this thing that, you know, anyone with enough money and the inclination would have a go at climbing.
And there have been 11 deaths so far in this climbing season.
And unlike in the past when climbers have been killed by avalanches or earthquakes, mountaineers we've been speaking to say this time it's mostly preventable errors, human errors.
What's happened?
Because of the cold and weather conditions, there's only a very, very brief window every year in which Everest can be climbed. And, you know, at its best, it might be 12 days during which the summit can be reached. Because the climbing window this year was so brief, deaths that may have occurred over a longer period of time, I mean, there were 7 or 8 deaths last year, were all compressed into this very tiny window. The accumulating body count and the speed with which it's accumulated has really shocked people, and it's sort of helped to drive a lot of these questions over whether Everest has become something that is too cheap in our imagination, whether it's beginning to suffer the impact of over-tourism.
The issue then of less experienced climbers, does that directly put other people at danger?
It does, because, you know, Everest is like a line system, and so if the person ahead of you is slow, is struggling, then that slows everyone behind them down. And it actually requires, in extreme cases, so very high up where time's of the essence, it requires people to actually, you know, walk, like clip around dead people.
It's just so grim, that image of human beings climbing around dead people to get to the top of a mountain.
Yeah, it's very stark. It's very stark. It's like an ugly view of humanity in a place that ought to be a setting that makes us like really proud of what we can achieve. And instead, it becomes a place for our like very worst qualities alongside our best.
So the climbers paying thousands for this trip, training really hard, that's one side of the story. How is this change, the overcrowding, the levels of experience, how's that changing things for the lives of the guides and the Sherpas who do this day in and day out?
So the Sherpas and people of other ethnicities who are now involved in helping people climb, I mean, they're really the silent heroes of this. They will be scaling the mountain ahead of people, guiding them, laying down ladders and other infrastructure. And in 2014, there was an avalanche that killed many of them, and that raised a lot of attention about the fact that they were often only getting a pittance of what many of the climbers were paying in order to reach the summit, and that the quality of their life insurance was really poor, and their mortality rate was 1.2%. So they're doing a job in which 1 in 100 die, and many of them are very poorly compensated, even though they make good money compared to the average Nepali. So we've seen movements in the last few years where Sherpas have unionized. There was a strike a few years ago where they refused to go up until their conditions were improved. We're beginning to very, very slowly see the inequality at the heart of the Everest industry start to be redressed.
So do you think things will change? Because obviously Everest is a big cash cow for the Nepalese government. Are they making any steps to change things?
The attitude of the Nepali government is that climbers themselves need to be better. And you can sympathize with them because on some level, there ought to be a bit of personal responsibility. I mean, this is Mount Everest, even though it does feel like it's a bit more feasible, it's a bit more achievable than it was in the past. But on the other hand, it is also an industry that is encouraging people to come. I mean, there are advertisements that have been quoted by some of these budget companies where it's like they're trying to sell you a set of steak knives. You know, they're trying to persuade you that, yes, even you can do this. Like, even you, an ordinary person, can manage this incredible once-in-a-lifetime feat.
It does all sound like a bit of a selfish scramble, doesn't it? What was it called? It was called the Goddess of the Sky.
That's right, yeah.
After climbing Everest many times, things now feel different for Elia, and he's seen the way that people view the mountain change.
You know, in the age of social media and Instagram and Facebook, that, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, beautiful images and seemingly ordinary people stand on top of the world, and I think that just instills, you know, dreams in people. The problem with that is that, you know, in an instant gratification world as well that we live in, I think people think it's too easy and they underestimate how serious Everest can be. And I always say, you know, Everest is very manageable on a good day, right? You know, with a commercial expedition and safety lines and, you know, Sherpas working on the mountain and bottled oxygen, it's very manageable. But, you know, when that weather changes or there's a massive lineup and people don't have the experience or the confidence, you know, to pass people or know how to get themselves out of trouble or even have that awareness of, you know, when they've sort of, you know, danced too far across the line and don't know when to quit, this is where you really start to see problems.
Would you go back? Is that your last climb?
You know, I think my mother would love to hear me say, yes, absolutely. You know, it's my last climb. I'm not certain at this point. You know, I was really turned off this year. And I'm just worried. You know, I'm really worried for, you know, the next, you know, years ahead of us and sort of, you know, what the state of the mountain's going to be and how much more, you know, lives are going to be lost. So I'm not sure if I'll head back. I certainly know that as I was climbing up, I was certainly doubting whether or not I would ever return.
You can read more on this story from Michael Safi at theguardian.com. Coming up, how Finland has tackled homelessness by simply giving people a home. Welcome back. Now, The Guardian's Europe correspondent, John Henley, has been looking at a solution to homelessness in Finland that's made Helsinki the only city in the EU to see numbers fall.
Mm-hmm. What's unique about the Finnish approach to homelessness is that they've adopted a policy called Housing First. You know, it does what it says on the can. It's about giving people a home first of all. The traditional approach to solving homelessness or trying to solve homelessness has been what they call a stepladder approach, where essentially you have to kind of earn accommodation, sort your life out, solve your, what if you've got addiction problems, get those sorted, get yourself a job, and then you might merit social housing. And the Finnish approach is basically to do the reverse, and is simply to say, we recognize that a stable, permanent home is actually probably going to be a prerequisite to you sorting the rest of your life out. So that's what they do. One of the ones that I visited was about 20 minutes from the centre of Helsinki. It was a former accommodation block for student teachers and converted into, I mean, really 21 really nice, kind of spacious one-bedroom apartments, home to 21 formerly homeless people. There's a communal kitchen and a communal living room. There's a sort of a mini gym. There's a fruit garden just across the road. There's a sauna. Finland being Finland, there pretty much kind of has to be a sauna. It's really a very pleasant place. One of the formerly homeless people that I spoke to described it basically as a miracle. He'd spent nearly a decade without a proper home. He'd lived in various communes. He'd been sleeping on his brother's sofa. He'd been in various kind of, you know, disastrous relationships. He'd slept rough for part of the time. And he just said, this is my chance to get my life back on track. And there are only two rules, really. The first is that you shouldn't be a menace in any way to the other people who are living there. And I guess the most important, because it's really kind of part of the principle of the thing, is that, yes, that you sign a contract. You're referred to as a tenant. And this is all part of a recognition that having a home of your own is also a responsibility. There's a six-month kind of temporary arrangement. But after that, as long as you continue to pay your rent, so, I mean, obviously most of them get housing benefit, the home is yours for as long as you want it. Most of them stay maybe 3-4 years and then move on, often into private rental accommodation of their own or other forms of social housing. It's not cheap. Finland has spent something like 230 million euros over the last sort of 10 years or so, but it's reduced long-term homelessness by 35%, and rough sleeping in Finland basically eradicated. In Britain, over the last 8-10 years or so, the number of people sleeping rough has nearly trebled. You know, it's gone from kind of 1,600-1,700 up to sort of 4,600-4,700. There have been various studies done that show that Housing First actually saves substantial amounts of money. Emergency healthcare, for example, but also sort of the police, you know, the criminal justice system, counsellors, all these kind of things that are required on a kind of very urgent basis for people when they are homeless. You know, all those are all things where you're going to be saving costs once they're in a home. What prompted the whole initiative was really just a recognition that the old approach to tackling homelessness simply wasn't working. This idea that you might be basically sort of plucked off the street and you'd have a shelter for a night and then you'd be kicked out again during the day. And it simply wasn't solving homelessness.
You can read more on this story, which is part of the When Europe Gets It Right series by Guardian Cities, at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Michael Safi, Elia Sakali and John Henley. Today's producers are Gary Marshall and Mithili Rao. Sound design is by Axel Kakutier. And the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.